Take back the city for yourself tonight. I'll take back the city for me. Take back the city for yourself tonight. Whoa, whoa.
Welcome to Third Paradigm, an out-of-the-box think tank about community sovereignty and regenerative economics. We look at how to take back our cities, farmland, and water, our money, production, and trade, our media, education, and culture, our religion, and even our God. We present a people's history of the Bible and a parent's view on how to raise giving kids in a taking world. I'm your host, Teresa Caraggio, broadcasting through Free Radio Santa Cruz, WHCL Hamilton College, Radio Lillooet, British Columbia, and Upstart Radio Online. Welcome to the 44th episode of Third Paradigm. Our title this week is Resistance and Waves of Loving Kindness. We'll look at the difference between the U.S. and Latin America in response to the dramatic events in Honduras. At the end of their third month of being under siege by the military coup, President Zelaya has re-entered the country and taken refuge in the Brazilian embassy. We'll reveal more news on that, but first I'd like to talk about the congressional response to scandals in two organizations, ACORN and the military contractor KBR. On Thursday, Amy Goodman interviewed the CEO of ACORN, Bertha Lewis. The Senate had just voted 83-7 to bar the group from receiving federal funds, and the House Minority Leader is calling on Obama to stop all federal aid. The impetus for this moral outrage is some illegally taken videos of instigators who repeatedly posed as a prostitute and a pimp in order to entrap ACORN employees into giving them tax advice. No official action was ever taken by ACORN. The same episode of Democracy Now! Reports that a former employee of the war contractor KBR can pursue her case in open court. Jamie Lee Jones sued KBR and its former parent company, Halliburton, claiming she was drugged and gang-raped by co-workers in Baghdad. The company kept her in a shipping container without food or water for at least 24 hours after the crime took place, and may have kept her there indefinitely but for a sympathetic guard who loaned her his cell phone. She called her dad in Texas, who got his representative, Ted Poe, to use state intervention to rescue her. For 2 years, neither Halliburton, the military, nor the justice system took any action to prosecute her attackers. Because of an employment contract created when Dick Cheney was Halliburton's CEO, Jones was told that her only recourse was mandatory binding arbitration. The judge would be chosen by Halliburton with all procedures secret and with no right to appeal. Finally, this week, a three-judge panel ruled that Jones can have her case heard in a neutral courtroom. So let me get this straight. An overloaded caseworker, who has seen worse things than you or I can ever imagine, gives tax advice to an undercover agent posing as a pimp. This is under duress, unbeknownst to anyone else. Instead of asking why a sting operation was set up to entrap ACORN employees and which banking interest funded it, the Senate freezes their money and calls on Obama to stop all federal funds. But a gang of KBR employees drugs and brutally rapes a woman, leaving her bruised, bleeding, and with torn pectoral muscles. The company doctors say they can't find the results of her rape test because so many women employees are drugged and raped. And then the company locks her into a shipping crate where who knows what would have happened if the guard hadn't loaned her a cell phone. Why hasn't Representative Ted Poe, who knows the truth in this situation, called on Congress to freeze KBR and Halliburton's federal funding? What's wrong with this picture? Before we get into Honduras, let's calm down with a September meditation from the Universal Unitarian Worship Materials and Having Come This Far by James Broughton. The music is Ever Loving by Moby. September Meditation. I do not know if the seasons remember their history, or if the days and nights by which we count time remember their own passing. I do not know if the oak tree remembers its planting, or if the pine remembers its slow climb towards sun and stars. I do not know if the squirrel remembers last fall's gathering, or if the blue jay remembers the meaning of snow. I do not know if the air remembers September or if the night remembers the moon. I do not know if the earth remembers the flowers from last spring or if the evergreen remembers that it shall stay so. Perhaps that is the reason for our births, to be the memory for creation. Perhaps salvation is something very different than anyone ever expected. Perhaps this will be the only question we will have to answer. What can you tell me about September? Having come this far, I've been through what my through was to be. I did what I could and couldn't. I was never sure how I would get there. I nourished an ardor for thresholds, for stepping stones and for ladders. I discovered detour and ditch. I swam in the high tides of greed. I built sandcastles to house my dreams. I survived the sunburns of love. No longer do I hunt for targets. I've climbed all the summits I need to, and I've eaten my share of lotus. Now I give praise and thanks for what could not be avoided, and for every foolhardy choice. I cherish my wounds and their cures, and the sweet enervations of bliss. My book is an open life. I wave goodbye to the absolutes and send my regards to infinity. I'd rather be blithe than correct. Until something transcendent turns up, I splash in my poetry puddle and try to keep God amused. The music was Everloving by Moby from the Play CD. Now that we've splashed in the poetry puddle, let's return to the quagmire of Honduras and the president whose brave and heroic return has made a big splash in it. Zelaya has walked for 15 hours, risking his life and freedom to re-enter Tegucigalpa and take refuge in the Brazilian embassy. Two people have been killed by the police, who shot live ammunition into the crowd gathered to protect him. In breaking news Friday, mass government agents sprayed toxic chemicals into the embassy, causing nausea, nosebleeds, spitting and defecating blood, rapid heartbeat, skin irritation, headache, and dizziness among the 87 people there. Courageously, First Lady Xiomara de Zelaya went to the roof to look at the machines they were using to spray the acid from neighboring buildings. She shouted, "Assassins! Assassins!" and they disconnected their apparatus. The 85 people accompanying the Zelayas say they won't desert them. If I ever have a granddaughter, I'm hoping she'll be named Xiomara. Where's the congressional outrage over this? In a blog post called The Audacity of Action, Amy Goodman writes, "Zelaya's bold move occurs during a critical week, with world leaders gathering for the annual United Nations General Assembly, followed by the G20 meeting of leaders and finance ministers in Pittsburgh. The Obama administration may be forced, finally, to join world opinion in decisively opposing the coup." But at the G20 meeting, Obama said, "Those who used to chastise America for acting alone in the world cannot now stand by and wait for America to solve the world's problems alone." Strange words for the only holdout on climate change. Strange words for a country with a military base in spitting distance from Tegucigalpa. When I recovered from the sense of vertigo this inversion of reality induced, I was led to wonder, will the ALBA countries wait forever to intervene militarily in Honduras? How many people will be killed, tortured, imprisoned, or disappeared before a continental peacekeeping force says, enough is enough? They already have Mercosur, UNASUR, and Bancosur. How long before a Milasur is formed? To answer this question, I went to the underground Journasur, the Latin American blog press, to ask whether Latin America is as confused as we are about the use of the term defense. Apparently, our government is composed of former football players who think it means a good offense. My Google search on Honduras came up with Postcards from the Revolution, a blog by a New York Caracas attorney named Eva Golinger. She's written The Chavez Code, cracking U.S. intervention in Venezuela, Bush versus Chavez, Washington's war on Venezuela, and most recently, Empire's Web, Encyclopedia of Interventionism and Subversion. Since 2003, she's been using the Freedom of Information Act to obtain evidence of the U.S. government's efforts to destabilize progressive movements in Latin America. I figured she would know what's really going on with things like the San Jose Agreement, which Hillary Clinton, Oscar Arias of Costa Rica, and Michelle Bachelet of Chile are pushing with renewed vigor on Zelaya's return. Let's listen to what Eva Golinger has to say about it. The San Jose Agreement of 12 points incorporated several of the requests of the coup regime into Arias's original proposal. Specifically, point number one was changed from calling for President Zelaya's immediate return to power to become a call for a government of unity and reconciliation, to be composed of members of the coup regime together with representatives from each political party. Zelaya would have been returned to the presidency, but with his hands completely tied. The proposal again called for amnesty for the coup regime and, in an inference to the coup regime's allegations against President Zelaya, also called for amnesty to be granted to him as well. This factor clearly legitimates the coup regime's theories. Another point incredibly called on the Zelaya government and supporters to refrain from convening a constitutional assembly, directly or indirectly, and in fact also ordered a refrain from even holding any kind of consultation, survey, or opinion poll on any issue remotely related to constitutional reform. This is absolutely outrageous because no government has the right to usurp the people's sovereign right to choose their form and model of government. This is not a right that can be transferred or taken away. It is inalienable. Another point called for presidential elections to be held in October instead of November, and then again prohibited the people from protesting such elections, regardless of outcome or process, or engaging in any kind of civil disobedience, insurrection, or any kind of manifestation of discontent regarding the political process in the country. That is also a completely outrageous and unacceptable usurpation of the people's innate right to protest and manifest their will. She ends, Zelaya is calling for insurrection in Honduras. Personally, I think that is the only way to resolve this situation with dignity. Comments on the article go further. This time, spend lots of money on defense among ALBA after this coup. Increase military spending 30-fold. Make sure that ALBA targets Colombia and then Panama. Don't be surprised if Peru doesn't jump at the chance either. But first strike at the coup, second take Colombia. Another says, the golpistas, coup backers, just gave people more reason to be angry with them. We'll reclaim La Patria of 7.5 million people soon. Marxist socialist encourages Eva. Only those people who are really beating the bullets economically and who have nothing to lose but a whole world to win, like Karl Marx said, are the ones who are willing to revolt against this capitalist oligarchic system. Another writes, people like this who simply wave away the armed struggle of the 80s as if it was all just some terrible, avoidable mistake, not only impugn the hard struggle and sacrifice of the participants of those struggles, but also give short shrift to the possibilities and realities of the present moment. If it comes to force of arms here, we must support the Honduran masses to the hilt. But this certainly isn't the American way. We mainstream the armed invasion and occupation of other countries, or the funding, training, and weaponization of paramilitaries by business interests, but we tell Zelaya any repercussions will be his fault if the people fight back. Should they wait for the U.S. Army base in Honduras to protect them from the coup? Why exactly do we have a military base there if not to protect the people? Perhaps it's to protect the coup leaders and business interests in case Latin America comes to the Hondurans' defense. We'll kill a few civilians, blame it on Venezuela, and use it as a pretense to launch another immoral war. And where are the U.S. activists? Singing Kumbaya. I just got a note from 5 nonviolence groups to come hear a trauma healing and transformation delegate who's just returned from Honduras. She's documenting how nonviolent protests are being met with excessive force and violence. They're providing resources, training, and support in active nonviolence. Armed with this information, advocacy groups can pressure international power holders for a diplomatic solution. To illustrate this point, let's listen to Derek Jensen with Star Wars, the environmentalist version.
I don't know if you know this, but the original draft of the movie Star Wars was not written by Lucas. The original draft was written by environmentalists, and it's a little bit different. For one thing, it wasn't actually called Star Wars. It was called Star Nonviolent Civil Disobedience. But the plot of Star Wars, for those of you who don't remember, is that the Empire has created this giant machine called a Death Star. And it's a machine that's capable of destroying entire planets. In the movie, the rebels find a way to destroy the Death Star. And then at the very end, Luke Skywalker uses the Force to get past all the TIE fighters and to drop a torpedo down a thermal exhaust port and to blow up the Death Star. Once again, the first draft of the movie, written by environmentalists, was a bit different. The rebels didn't actually blow up the Death Star. Instead, they used other methods to slow the intergalactic march of empire. For example, they set up programs for people on planets about to be destroyed to produce luxury items like hemp hacky sacks and gourmet coffee for sale to inhabitants of the Death Star. Audience members will also discover there are plans afoot to encourage loads of troopers and other citizens of the Empire to take eco-tours of doomed planets. Their purpose will be to show to one and all that these planets are economically important to the Empire and so should not be destroyed. In a surprise move that will get viewers to the edges of their seats, other groups of rebels file lawsuits against the Empire, attempting to show that the environmental impact statement that Darth Vader was required to file failed to adequately support his decision that blowing up the planet would cause no significant impact. Viewers will thrill to learn of plans to boycott items produced by corporations that have Darth Vader on the board of directors, and they'll leap to their feet in theaters worldwide when they see bags full of letters written directly to Mr. Vader himself, asking that he please not blow up any more planets. Now, we all know that that would be enough not only to bring the Empire to its knees, but to make a damn fine and exciting movie. The thing is, there's more. Thousands of renegade rebels, unhappy with what they perceive as toadying on the part of mainstream rebels, decide in a scene guaranteed to bring tears to even the eyes of the most cold-hearted theatergoers to stand on planets about to be destroyed, link arms, and sing Give Peace a Chance. They send DVDs of that to Darth Vader and his boss, the Grand Moff Tarkin, to whom they also send wave after wave of loving kindness. A few of the rebels sneak aboard the Death Star and they lock themselves down to various pieces of equipment, and stirring debates are held on screen as to whether the rebels should voluntarily surrender on approach of the troopers or whether they should remain locked down to the end. And in a brilliant and brave touch of authenticity, the rebels are never able to come to consensus. But there's more. Once inside the Death Star, there's a splinter group breaks off, they burn a couple of transporters, and they etch Galaxy Liberation Front. And then another group breaks off from that group, and they finally make it to Darth Vader's private room. And when they get there, they sneak up behind him, and they hit him with a vegan cream pie. And the directors decided to cut that because it was way too close to a scene in another movie they were developing at the same time called The Plot to Pie Hitler. As the Death Star looms directly overhead, a few of the rebels advocate picking up weapons to fight back. And those rebels are generally shouted down by the pacifist rebels, who argue that attacking those who run the Death Star is just another example of the Empire's harmful philosophy coming in by the back door. If we want to change Darth Vader, they say, we must first become that change ourselves. To change Darth Vader's heart, we must first change our own. We must, above all else, have compassion for Darth Vader and remember that he, too, was once a child. So finally, Leia, Luke, Han, Chewbacca, and a couple of robots show up, and they tell these others they found a way to blow up the whole Death Star. And the rest of the rebels, of course, are just horrified. There's a scuffle breaks out between Leia, Luke, Han, Chewbacca, and the two robots on one side and the pacifists on the other. And the pacifists chase those four from the room and from the film, which is not a big deal because they're minor characters anyway. But anyway, the way the movie ends is that the Death Star looms closer and closer, and then you see the Death Star, and then you see the planet, and then you see the Death Star, you see the planet, and then you see the Death Star, and you see the lasers start to glow this hellish red, and then you see the planet again, and then you see this little light, and what that is, that's the environmentalist getting away before the planet gets blown up. And you see the Death Star again, and then it blows up the planet. And then the final shot of the movie, which reveals what a complete triumph this was for the rebels, is a still showing an article on the lower left of page 43 of the New Empire Times that devotes a full three sentences to the destruction of the planet. So it's like, yeah, we got some press.
That was Derek Jensen. Frequent listeners know that his book, The Culture of Make-Believe, was my own wake-up call, an alarm buzzer I couldn't find the snooze button to turn off. When I asked another woman if she'd heard of Derek Jensen, she said, "Oh, you mean my fantasy lover," which shows how sexy truth-telling can be. I wonder if Derek ever thought he'd be the environmentalist pinup boy. The video can be found at nciv.com. It's directed by Franklin Lopez, who was born in Puerto Rico. His first breakthrough film was Join the Resistance, Fall in Love, followed by the post-Katrina video remix, George Bush Don't Like Black People. His site, submedia.tv, was selected by Wired magazine in the top 10 video sites. And he was hired to produce Democracy Now! His online news series, It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine, is broadcast on the Dish Network and watched by tens of thousands of loyal fanatics. He's producing NCIV as a crowd-funded film for $150,000. He doesn't accept any money from foundations or corporations, but only from individuals or groups who he'll acknowledge in the credits. The subtitle of NCIV is Resist or Die. So let's go back to Eva Golinger's Postcards from the Resistance. Another comment in the list references the U.S. policy think tank, the Council on Foreign Relations. They set out Washington's conditions for Zelaya through Kevin Casas Zamora, Oscar Arias' second vice president, who then became a fellow at the council. In Casas' exact words, "My sense of what the international community is demanding, and what is correct, is first of all that Zelaya should return to the presidency, though not necessarily to power. The presidency and power are two different things. Number two, he has to end his plans to amend the Constitution, which won't be much of a problem. Number three, he has to put some distance between himself and Chavez. That's essential. Number four, there has to be some kind of power-sharing agreement whereby Zelaya remains at the helm of the government, but some other people chip in the main decisions that are to be made between now and the next election in November. Number five, there has to be some kind of amnesty, for lack of a better word, where everybody turns a blind eye on the pervasive illegal behavior of all the parties involved, because all of them have acted with illegal behavior and have acted with total disregard for the rule of law." I have to confess a complete jealousy of Eva that she has such intelligent and thoughtful contributors. Even her critics seem to be on topic and debating strategy issues. By contrast, I recently posted an article to IndieBay about donors demanding that Free Radio Santa Cruz stand behind the independent news or refund their donations. You'd think that this would be relevant to a discussion board on independent media in Santa Cruz. Instead, they erased my post and replaced it with an article called "Bilingual Programming Under Fire at Free Radio Santa Cruz, at KPFK, at WBAI, and at KPFT. My comments were forwarded to this thread out of context. Rather than being pro-independent news, they've now been framed as anti-Latino. The most recent post is titled, "Get Your Tinfoil Hats" by Voice of Smartness. It reads, "For those of you engaged in debate with Teresa, I would highly advise a gander at her website. 1. She is all about Teresa. 2. She is a lunatic, to put it politely. 3. She is an anti-Semite who is trying to use ancient Jewish history to attack modern Jews and put all blame for Mideast conflict on them. If not crazy, I definitely think the possibility that she is a provocateur should be considered. Her demand that donations be refunded is either the demand of a crazy person or possibly a provocateur's attempt to destabilize Free Radio Santa Cruz. The pro-Palestinian movement is heavily infiltrated by CIA, FBI, and other. Something to consider. They then reference episode number 16 on Nasty Noah and the Patriarchs. I'd like to respond. I'm not using ancient Jewish history to attack modern Jews. If Noah really did rape his grandson Canaan, as Jewish scriptures lead me to conclude, I say, it's been 5,000 years. Let's let bygones be bygones. I'd never visit the sins of the father on their great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren anyway. However, Noah's curse of Canaan for ratting him out continues to provide the only justification for the land grab from Canaan's descendants, the Palestinians. I'm holding modern Jews responsible for their own actions. They're using the word of a pedophile in ancient Jewish history to not hold themselves responsible because the pedophile speaks for God. For Third Paradigm, this has been Teresa Caraggio. Thanks to Skidmark Bob for production, editing, and the videos and music in this week's show. Thanks to Mike Sirocco, you can view Star Wars, an environmentalist version, embedded in the transcript with photos, links, and music videos at thirdparadigm.org. We go out with the band Muse and the song Uprising. In